edition of the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, your host for today. Glad to be back in the week doing the program and really excited to be here with our guests. Remember, you could always get information about upcoming shows and topics and events at naturalnurse.com. She has the day off today, the Natural Nurse, and or drznaturally.com. So we have a very interesting guest here. We have Justin Ehrlich. He's a licensed acupuncturist out in San Diego, California. And he does a lot of different things besides just Chinese medicine. He's actually studied Taoism for a very long time. And he uses that to help people with connecting emotionally and with their mind state and look at the origin of disease and experience and personal development. He does lifestyle coaches and diet therapy. He does something called Tao Yin, which we'll talk about, and Qigong, practices various types of Vipassana and Zen meditation, and does something called biohacking, modern biohacking. I'm going to ask him about that, and many things like that. So we're going to be talking about Justin's work on patients and give a new angle to health and healing right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Hey, welcome, Justin.
Good morning.
Great to hear from you.
Yeah, great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about, we all have our own journeys of how we kind of found natural medicine or ancient medicine. I'd like to hear about yours.
Well, I kind of first got exposed to Chinese medicine and the idea of taking care of oneself on a health level via martial arts. I started at a very young age, so just sort of becoming aware of the physical body and what it can do and how to take care of it via stretching, via exercise, via breathing techniques, via meditation. And just really resonated with it even at an early age and kind of drew me in. I hadn't really considered being an acupuncturist per se as a career until sometime in college when a friend said something to me. It was, I think, after I had finished my undergraduate, and was like, why don't you go to school to be an acupuncturist? And it was like somebody had sort of smacked me upside the head. So I worked for a little while, went back to school, and haven't looked back.
Interesting. What martial art do you practice? I have different black belts in a few styles and have trained in many different forms and, you know, different styles of Tai Chi and things like that as well.
I have done some Chen style Tai Chi, some Yi Chuan. My main style of practice is a southern style of Kung Fu called Hong Ga, or Hong Kyun, really famous in the movies. It's a southern style of martial art, a mixture of internal and external practices. So it uses some of the internal mechanics and breath work that you might see in something like Tai Chi or Xing Yi.
Yeah, that's misunderstood amongst Westerners. They think Kung Fu was just, for fighting. Tell us about your understanding of how that originated. That'd be really interesting to dispel those myths.
Yeah, I mean, Kung Fu is, you know, martial arts in general, of course, exist across all cultures. And they've existed for, you know, for as long as humans have probably needed to defend themselves, they've had fighting techniques to make defending themselves more efficient. And I think there's a big difference sort of between Kung Fu for health and Kung Fu for fighting, whether that be stepping into the ring and doing MMA, whether that be military-based self-defense that the military or police, security agents, bodyguards may have to study, and then martial arts, which are also happen to be good for your health. And they're just sort of different sides of the same coin, depending on how you train it, depending on how you use it. It can be better or worse for your body, or better, gentler on your body.
One of the masters that's I'm taking right now, I'm involved in Kung Fu Do from
Okay.
Korea. Yeah.
Yeah.
But one of the masters is doing her thesis. You know, in order to gain rank in the belt system in Kung Fu Do, we have to do thesis, I guess. And so he's doing this thing that's very interesting, is should the martial arts adapt to the age of the practitioner? And she sent out a survey that I have to fill out and turn in tomorrow about should that be the case? And particularly, she sent it to those, 50 and older, which, I'm one of those. So, and I've noticed, that my training in the martial arts has changed a lot to more learning internal ways to heal yourself, make yourself, impermeable, impregnable as far as disease and injury, particularly, and moving the chi and energy to basically help heal injuries very fast. And so I know that many of the martial arts schools develop their own types of botanical formulas, hit
Hit
wines
medicine,
and things
yeah.
like that. Talk a little bit about that, and I know you do that type of work, but that fascinates me.
Yeah.
Myself and Ellen, who we just did a webinar on, using Chinese and other herbs and natural medicine for actual first aid medicine. And we don't really think of herbs as like first aid, when we think about going to the emergency room, but these cultures have developed a huge repertory of treatments for that.
Yeah, so I mean there are a couple of facets that make the Chinese approach a little different, but fundamentally it's still the same human body. And so sometimes the language that's used to describe these things is a little different. But whether they call it heat or we call it acute inflammation, whether they call it dampness or we call it swelling, it's there's still a certain physical cascade that occurs when you sprain your ankle or when you break a bone. And there's certain biological process that has to happen for the bone to knit back together, for the tendon to re-tighten up so that it's not overstretched, to have the tissues heal, to clear out the bruising, to not have too much scar tissue or chronic pain after an old injury. And martial artists historically were sort of the osteopaths of China. So they
Interesting.
studied manual manipulation techniques to reset a dislocated joint, to set broken bones, help heal injuries. And they came up with a lot of topical products as well, as internal products to be used. So the really famous sort of within the martial arts community have called hit wine or dita jiao, which is the Cantonese pronunciation of basically what means fall and hit wine. And some of those formulas are for internal use and some of those are for external use. And you're basically making a tincture where you're soaking herbs and alcohol, and then taking that internally to help reduce pain, reduce swelling, stop the sort of negative facets of the inflammatory cascade, because we do need a certain amount of inflammation or activity of the immune system for wounds or injuries to heal. So you don't want to shut down the immune system entirely, which is where we see some of the negative impacts of too much ice therapy or too much nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories. When somebody has an injury, then the injury doesn't heal because the immune system has been shut down too much. And the Chinese over time came up with quite a few. I mean, there's hundreds of Dita Jiao recipes out there.
Yeah. Herbal ice
Most.
too. Herbal ices, as you mentioned before, like kind of
Yeah.
they frowned upon ice. Now, I don't know whether that's a historical thing, whether they just didn't have ice many thousands of years ago, unless it was winter, or you were in northern China or up in the
Yeah.
mountains,
They tend to. The Chinese look at the body as a warm-blooded, a yang phenomena, and so we need our circulation to be moving. They recognize that if you had too much inflammation in an area, you needed to cool it down. And in some parts of northern China, they would have had access to ice, but for the majority part, they just didn't have it as a tool. But even since then, they've had access to ice for, you know, for many, many years. And they still frown upon it because they feel that using herbal poultices or plasters, liniments, and internal medicine are a much more efficient way to reduce inflammation and support healing. The Chinese would almost always use a removable splint or cast for an injury. And so underneath the cast, you would have a plaster or a poultice on the skin helping to heal the tissues while the damaged bone or joint was also stabilized in the way that we do in the West. But in the West, we don't put anything underneath the cast. And so by using a plaster or poultice, you can really reduce the healing time, but you need to be working with somebody who has the capacity to change that out without, you know, damaging the alignment of the broken bone that's been reset.
Yeah, very interesting. Fascinating stuff.
A
Tell
lot of
us a little bit
times,
about your oh, go ahead. You have more another comment to make. I was going to move on.
a lot of
Yeah.
times, you know, if you broke a bone or if you sprained an ankle, you'd go see the local martial arts teacher, and they would be the person that would take care of that. You wouldn't go to your primary internal medicine doctor. You'd go to somebody that was also happened to be a martial artist, and they would be the osteopath that would set the bone and set you up.
Yeah.
And you might go back every day. You might go back once a week, all depending on how severe the injury is.
I've done so much with my own injuries. It's amazing. That's what kind of furnished the information for this webinar that myself and the natural nurse did across the world, actually, on using. And I, you know, showed pictures of my MRIs and healing, and particularly my boxing fracture that I got on my hand. You know, I broke some of the hand bones splitting wood, and how I cut the healing time really in half and just amazed my hand doctor, so much so that I was able that in a few weeks he let me he released me and said, "Well, there's not much I can do. You seem to be on a great path." I'm sure you have a lot of stories of that using you know, your ancient medicines with your patients.
Well, Ditta medicine, the trauma medicine from China, is really remarkable. And on average, it will reduce the healing time by about half. Sometimes a little more than that, sometimes a little less. But that would be my experience with it over the years, is it really will reduce healing by half. And then, you know, in a way, even more important than reducing the healing time by half is that when you do resolve it, you have less scar tissue, you have less chronic inflammation in the area, so you get a lot less arthritis in the joints that are affected as well. So not only does it help you in the short term, it also helps you in the long term as well.
But here's an interesting fact, Justin. And if you're just joining us, we're with Justin Ehrlich. He's an acupuncturist, does integrated Chinese medicine out in San Diego. Yeah, when I really tore out my knee, like I was fighting this black belt guy, and we had to do this for some of our testing. And, you know, he was a very advanced practitioner, but it was this. So this is interesting. I'm going to give you a loaded question here. It was the springtime, okay? And he kicked me hard, and I felt such rage of anger that when I went up and did this complex kick and landed wrong and tore my knee, you know, that was it. I tore medial collateral, ACL, things like that. So I was finished, but I found it interesting in retrospect that
What happened in
what preceded the injury was not the fact that, yeah, I did a high kick and landed wrong. That's true. And I wanted to kill this guy. I felt like I lost control with anger. And that in Western medicine may not really mean much, but in medicine that you've studied, that means everything. Tell us a little bit about Chinese medicine and the emotions and and how it corresponds to health.
Yeah, so as a quick response to your comments, the emotion of anger is associated with the liver in Chinese medicine. And the liver in part controls the health of our tendons and ligaments, also in Chinese medicine. So having a lot of heat, a lot of anger, a lot of agitation in the liver would make the liver more prone to inflammation, but that is more than just the liver organ itself within the paradigm of Chinese medicine. And so it also makes your tendons and your ligaments more prone to injury at the same time. We can look at that on a biological level in the sense that when we are in a space of extreme anger or rage or something like that, all of the neurological signaling is kind of up at the surface of the body. All this energy kind of rises up and outward because we're moving outward to express that anger. But also by default means we're also not very grounded and calm. And so our capacity to control our body to do fine motor skills is also very limited because all the energy is up at the surface and we're not very grounded and calm. We're agitated. It's what you see in, you know, whether it be fear, whether it be anger, extreme facets of either one of those will affect our fine motor skills and make us more prone to injury. So whether, you know, from the biomedical model, it may not make sense that the liver affects the sinews and leaves us more prone to injury. We also kind of know that it is also like you can see the truth of it in human behavior and how the mechanics work and how our fine motor skills are and how that affects propensity to injury. To the Chinese, emotions are just vectors of movement. Anger is energy that rises up in our body. Fear is what causes our body to contract, to retreat, to pull inward. Laughter allows the body to relax and sort of spread out, to soothe, to kind of relax is probably the best way to describe it. Fear causes us to contract. Sorrow causes us to kind of move inward and downward, kind of into that sort of like fetal position.
How about where we are overthinking? Like people that overthinking. Spleen energy.
Yeah, overthinking is associated with the spleen. And it's overthinking in the sense of sort of obsessive compulsive kind of overthinking. More obsessive. Because you're not necessarily acting on it, which would be the compulsive part. The spleen and stomach are a pairing in Chinese medicine that deal with our digestion, our metabolism. The acupuncture channels, the stomach acupuncture channel has multiple pathways. And we think of the acupuncture channels, we tend to think of just like one little fine line running across the body where there are these points. And it's not really the best description of what they are. But the stomach acupuncture channel, its primary branch is just on the face. It's just on the head. And it runs from underneath the eyes, past the nose, past the mouth, past the jaw, the ear, and then up to the head. And what the Chinese were saying by that is that the stomach has to digest everything that we see, everything that we smell, everything that we taste, everything that we hear, and everything that we think. And so obsessive thinking, overthinking, overworks the stomach and spleen. In Chinese medicine, can damage our digestive system because we're constantly chewing on the same thing. We're obsessing over one thought. It's like chewing on an apple. You keep chewing on the same apple forever, there's going to be something not right about it. We have to kind of swallow whatever it is that we're chewing on and move on to the next bite of food. We can't keep that same bite in our mouth. And if we keep the same thought in our head, whether that be a traumatic thought, whether that be a happy thought, if we surround ourselves with the same substances all the time, if we obsess over things, then it can be damaging to the body.
Wow, that's a great description of that, chewing on things. And then, of course, if we're not digesting the food, I know the spleen's job is to kind of refine the food and remove the good qi and allow the waste to go through and also to build up the blood. Tell us about the concept of blood and qi in Chinese medicine.
Yeah, so the Chinese are basically Chinese medicine is basically a system of duality, yin and yang, qi and blood, body and spirit. So you have the physical body and you have the something that is beyond the physical. In Taoism, we like to break it down into maybe more three models of the physical body, the emotional body, and the spiritual body. But the qi represents this idea of the functional energy of the body. That can be the neurological signaling, the impulse that comes from the central nervous system out to the muscles to get you to move, to walk, to be able to practice martial arts or to pick up the phone. It's also the intrinsic beat of the heart, the peristalsis of the gut. That's all a functional facet of the body. So is the immune system, the way that T cells work, the way that the body breaks down dead cells and autophagy and heals tissues and all that sort of stuff. And then the blood represents more the fluid system of the body, the substance of the body, the hormones, the hydration, the interstitial fluids, all that sort of stuff. And Chinese medicine can go deeper and we can break it apart into hormonal fluids and versus sweat. And we can break it down in the same way that Western medicine does, in terms of more subtleties. But blood represents the sort of internal facet of the body, the substance of the body. Blood is also in Chinese medicine something that we produce via the digestive process. It's how we take a carrot and we turn it into something that's useful for our body. We chew on it, it goes into the stomach, it gets digested, and then from there we know anatomically it goes to the small intestine, large intestine, we get rid of it. But in the process, the spleen, which is the language used in Chinese medicine, contributes a certain portion of that, and that's often related to the pancreas in Western medicine. The Chinese didn't use the term for the pancreas, but the spleen basically provides, within the Chinese paradigm, the idea of some enzymatic activity to help further refine the digestive process so that we're able to extract nutrition from the foods that we eat. And then by extracting that nutrition, we turn the carrot into something that is useful. So whether that's getting the beta carotene out of it so that the carrot benefits our eyes, or whether that be extracting the vitamin K out of a bunch of kale so that it's good for our bones or good for our heart or good for our liver. That would be sort of the function of the digestive system to make sure we get the most out of our foods. And that would be the spleen and stomach in Chinese medicine.
Yeah, so it seems like that's critical that's super important to health, but it's interesting that Western medicine kind of ignores the digestive system. They actually do things to turn it off during GERD and things like that. And I know in, you know, naturopathic medicine, which of course took many of its, a lot of its information from, you know, the ancient systems, that's a faux pas to really, we want to tonify and strengthen the digestive system, which I guess as we get older, just kind of wanes like all of the systems. And so one of the keys is to keep digestion strong. And I guess one of the ravages that you see in the elders, anything from osteoarthritis to osteoporosis to even problems with the mind and all the organs, really sometimes has the genesis in the digestive system. Is that quite true?
It is, yeah. Within Chinese medicine, there's actually, being that it's been around for thousands of years, there are many different schools of medicine. So you have medicine, a whole branch of Chinese medicine that focuses primarily on digestion. And they see digestion as the source of all disease. Mm. There are parts that focus on exposure to the elements or how we internalize the world and other things as well. But the school of digestion was actually really kind of formed around the year 1200, roughly, by a famous physician of Chinese medicine named Li Dongyuan. And he lived in the late 1100s to the mid 1200s, and formed a whole school of Chinese medicine based around digestion, because obviously if we can't digest everything that we take in, whether that be the carrot, or whether that be a conversation with somebody, whether that be the information that we're given in school as we're trying to learn and grow as a child, we can't really thrive.
Right, yeah.
If we can't extract nutrition out of all the experiences that we take in, then we're not nourished. And so if the body's not nourished, of course, eventually you have, on a physical level, you have cachexia, where the body begins to waste away, becomes weaker, the immune system becomes weaker, but it also affects us intellectually and emotionally and spiritually as well. You know, you can think of it as you hear it even within the psycho-spiritual worlds of sort of emotional starvation or spiritual starvation, mimicking the impacts of physical starvation. It's an interesting concept. It's also why, to the Chinese, breath work, breathing practices, end up being so important and so central to most of their spiritual practices. And really, you see breath work is central to most spiritual practices around the world, whether that be in the form of chanting or singing, or actual physical breathing patterns. And that's that, you know, the stomach is really a gateway into the sort of earthly realm of existence. We eat food to subsist on here, because if we stop eating at a certain point, the body will eventually perish. But we also have the capacity to fast and not eat for long periods of time.
But we can't breathe, though. We can't breathe, though.
Exactly.
Stop breathing. Exactly. So the breath has to be, you know, maybe a superior modality, actually, when I'm, you know, versus
The breath represents the non-physical part of this existence. It's sort of the one way we can connect into heaven, according to the Chinese. The air, literally the oxygen, the air that we breathe, is called heavenly qi. And if we lose that connection to heaven, we die in a matter of minutes. But we can lose our connection to food and exist for a long time with just even something as simple as water fasting.
Mm-hmm.
So it just sort of is interesting how the role of breath actually really becomes a gateway into spiritual practices, much more so than eating. And a lot of spiritual practices, of course, move more and more towards fasting, just kind of break away from the earth. But for existing within society, we have to eat. We have to have a healthy digestive system, because if not, we can't integrate with society. Because it takes a lot of digestion as we navigate traffic, as we navigate paying our taxes, as we navigate all that. We have to sort of take it in, make sense of it, and turn it into something hopefully useful for our bodies.
So all this stress, listening to the news, if you don't believe in the politics, as Peter Tosh used to say, the famous reggae artist, politics. Mm-hmm. So that can affect people's health, hearing negative news, hearing Washington in turmoil, hearing, you know, whatever, it's things you don't agree with and whatnot. And if you turn it into emotions, that can be damaging to your health then.
Yeah, and it's not that emotions are bad. Emotions are just a natural part of human existence. You know, we get happy, we get sad, we get angry. There's nothing wrong with that, according to Chinese medicine or according to Taoism. It's more if we get stuck in it. If I'm angry for, like, really just angry for weeks and weeks on end, that's damaging to the body. But if, you know, if we don't know each other and one of us walks up and punches the other person in the face, it's perfectly fine if we get angry at each other, you know?
Yeah.
All right, that's a normal, healthy response. If somebody I love passes away, I'm going to be sad. There's nothing unhealthy about grief, or joy or anger or fear. Drop me in a cage with a tiger that's hungry and I'm going to be scared. And that's normal and healthy.
Yeah.
But staying in that state permanently or for weeks and weeks on end can be very bad for the body as well. And regrettably, with the American political system being what it is, we are kind of stuck in a certain space of fear and anger and all that as a culture, which is definitely not good for us.
You mentioned Taoism, and people, like, they hear Confucianism, Taoism, these terms kind of thrown out, but maybe they have no idea the time period, who these people were that influenced this thought, what the philosophy is. Can you talk about that in the context of how it shaped Chinese medicine?
Yeah, Taoism has been a big, has been a central part of Chinese medicine for ever since its origins. And even within Taoism, like other world religions, there are different sects or different branches of it. That is also the case with Taoism. But Taoism is basically a mixture of philosophy and religion. They have their own belief in the sort of origin of life. So anything that discusses the origin of life, I would personally classify as a religion, even though they don't necessarily follow all the same sort of religious practices that we would associate with religion in the West. But it's also a philosophical perspective on the origin of life and how the human body works and how nature works. And Taoism is very much about the microcosm and macrocosm, that sort of what plays out inside of us mirrors what plays out outside of us. So what you see in nature, you see in humanity. What you see in the universe, you see in humanity. And the Taoist sort of philosophical perspective is that we have these sort of three facets of ourself, our emotional self, our spiritual self, and our physical self. And they have lots of different language for it. Probably the most common is this idea of Jing, Qi, and Shen. Jing being the physical body, the essence of the body, Qi being the functional energy of the body, the relationship facet of the body, and Shen being the spirit of the body. If you read things on Taoist cultivation or you hear things about it, you hear about these sort of alchemical meditation techniques of how do you transform Jing to Qi and Qi to Shen, and then Shen eventually back to emptiness or the void. And on a very like basic practical level, the Taoists basically believe that we're all here for a purpose. You have a very specific reason that you're here in life, different than mine. And we have some overlaps because we're all humans. And the goal of cultivation, in a way, is to begin to understand what is your specific purpose. Why did the things that happened in your life happen in your life? How did they make you who you are? And what is there within all of those things that is a healing process for you, because you're becoming more in touch with who you are, and you see these events, which maybe historically you saw as a trauma, as something negative, a broken heart, a divorce, an injury, the loss of a loved one to a disease. You start to see them not that they aren't sad anymore, but that you see them as how they made you who you are and how they eventually allowed you to become your fullest self, your most complete self, or your most evolved self. And so a lot of the practices are about a certain amount of introspection and learning about who we are and why we are what we are.
Important stuff, yeah. More like dharmic stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, why am I the way that I am? Why do I have the quirks that I have? We know that in
how do Western. People, if people come see you as a practitioner, how do you make them figure that out? What's the self-practice that allows people to unravel that mystery?
Well, there's a lot of different tools that Taoists developed over time, lots of meditation techniques that can be complicated and that sort of stuff. But it really, what I find is you just begin to help people connect the dots across their life to help them start to see some patterns that are there. So one of the things that I like to have people do, and I do with all my clients, is a life history. And you know, you start to look at your life, and I have people do 5-year blocks, 0 to 5, 6 to 10, 11 to 15, and sort of go through your life and look at all of the major physical events, the major emotional events, and the major sort of spiritual existential awakenings or crises. And start to see how those things show up in your life. You know, we have, in a sense, for all of us, we have our genetic patterning, things that we inherit from our parents or from our grandparents, and call that the epigenetics, right? The DNA that's handed down. We have our big life events that sort of, like, I was really wanted to be a baseball player, and then my coach embarrassed me for not throwing the perfect game, and then I quit baseball and never played again. You had some sort of major life trauma, emotional trauma, that derailed you from being pursuing your dream. And we have our sort of things that we choose to accept, that we sort of make excuses for. Oh, I'd like to do this, but I really can't, you know, because I have the social obligation. Oh, I really can't do this because of that. Or, you know, it's not really great the way that the person treats me, but I can't really say anything to them because they're my boss. Or, you know, they're having a bad day, so I'm just going to accept it or whatever. But we have basically these sort of predispositions. We have these bigger events that affect us and how we navigate life. And then we have our sort of how we justify the world around us. And we, as we begin to look at those patternings within ourselves, where do I make excuses for people? Where were the big turning points in my life? What are the emotional, spiritual, physical patternings that run in the family? Do we have diabetes that runs in the family? Do we have heart disease or certain cancers? You can start to see certain patterns that are there. And once you see the pattern, you now have the capacity to start to change it. And that's, in a sense, what Taoist cultivation is around, is sort of becoming aware of those things and then choosing to change them, to not pass on a gene of diabetes that runs in the family, to not, you know, activate that
gene. And sometimes it's behavior too. Like, you know, it's interesting that diabetic behaviors epigenetics, like ways of eating, ways of looking at life, ways of thinking. Now, whether they're genetic or and predisposed, and you're saying it's not a prison, your genes aren't a prison, that with Taoist techniques you can not express those things that your the wrongs of the ancestors, so to speak, you know, the karma,
exactly,
wrongs of the ancestors in your present lineage and future lineage.
On a religious level, the Taoists basically believe we choose this life to have those experiences so that we can actually graduate from them. I choose a parent that has diabetes that's going to pass on the gene of diabetes to me and the lifestyle of diabetes to me so that I can realize this is not sustainable. Let me change the lifestyle. Let me not activate that gene. Let me learn how to take better care of myself and break that cycle of behavior. But that could also be for alcoholism. That could be for, you know, abuse of any sort.
Depression, repetitive thinking, those types of patterns too, everything,
Exactly, yeah. Wow. Anything on the physical, the emotional, the spiritual level are all things that we learn from our parents and we pick up from them, for better, for worse, right? Some very wonderful behaviors we pick up from our parents, and we also pick up some quirks. And it's like, are we going to indulge them or are we going to make note of what it is and be like, no, I choose something different for myself. I choose something different for my offspring, for my kids. I don't want them to grow up in the world that I grew up in. I want them to grow up in something different.
Very profound and very powerful. Yeah. So that's one thing that you've been doing, I guess, with your clients and helping them with personal growth and things like
finding,
that. You know.
For anybody facing a very chronic disease, I've done a lot of work with autoimmune diseases and
tell us about that, because that's one of my specialties. I wrote, Dr. Kamai, the natural nurse, and myself have written many books and articles. I also teach rheumatology and autoimmune disease at the university. I'd like to see your take on it. It would be really interesting.
So in the basic premise of how the immune system is overactive in a way that it shouldn't be and is attacking the body is basically the same in Chinese medicine or in Western medicine. We know that that's what's happening. There's some degree of inflammatory cascade that's happening in a way that it shouldn't be, that's uncontrolled, whether that's in the gut or that's in the joints or that's in the brain or that's in the blood vessels. We now have different in the skin. We can give it all sorts of names for the different forms of autoimmune disease. But it's still the body attacking itself. It's the immune system doing something that it shouldn't. And
right, that's forbidden. That's really forbidden to have those clones of T cells and B cells that are
they're not behaving.
Self destruction. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the strategy in Chinese medicine is to figure out, well, what is the why is the body doing this? What does the body think is going on? So when somebody has leaky gut and develops an Hashimoto's thyroiditis or gets RA or gets psoriasis, the Chinese approach is to look and see, like, well, what's causing it? The fact that the body is attacking these foreign proteins isn't really the problem. The problem is that the foreign proteins are there. So let's go back and try and treat the root of the problem while we control the manifestation of the branch, the symptoms. So the irritation on the skin in psoriasis, or the irritation in the joints, or the elevated stressors on the thyroid and all the downstream cascade that occurs with that, those are all the branch coming from the leaky gut. And then you could even go deeper and say, well, why did the gut become leaky? And trying to work with that as a deeper root. But when we're working with an autoimmune disease, we sort of, depending on how severe the symptoms are when the patient presents, we will first try to clear some of that inflammatory cascade so the body quits damaging itself. But we're trying to get to the root cause of the problem. So if it's the leaky gut, it's healing the gut. If there's a latent virus, a latent Epstein-Barr, or a latent infection like Lyme's disease, or something like along those lines.
Like a stealth infection, too, has been implicated in many of these things. Yeah,
exactly. It's sort of, how do we flush that out? And there's a whole branch of acupuncture channels that really represent that theory.
Oh, really?
So when we talk about the lung channel or the large intestine or the stomach, there are basically five different acupuncture channel systems. You have what are known as the eight extraordinary vessels, which are our primary sort of genetic makeup. These are the channels that are really primarily formed in utero and represent our genetic unfolding. And so if you have a genetically inherited disease and you're trying to help the person to heal from that, these are often the acupuncture channels that you work with. You're working with something that really truly is passed down in the DNA. We have our primary channels, which is what most acupuncturists treat. And those are the ones that affect our day-to-day experiences. But they don't really touch into the genetic level of the body.
Mm.
We have our tendinomuscular channels, which deal with how we move the physical body. So when you come in with a sprained ankle, or you damaged your medial collateral ligament, and we treat you for that, we're not treating your genetics. We're treating the muscles, the tendons, the ligaments. You know, we're working with the physical body. We have something called the low connecting channels, which deal with the circulation of blood, which is our internal world, our emotions, our mind, our thoughts. And then we have something known as the channel divergences, which are sort of areas of the body that hold latency, that hold these long-term hidden infections. And so that channel system is what we often use when you're trying to treat somebody who comes in with something like rheumatoid arthritis or Epstein-Barr, any Hashimoto's, any sort of autoimmune, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's.
Yeah, sure. Many
of that sort of stuff. Children, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so we use those as areas where often there's some degree of pathology being hidden from the body. And so it represents this idea that you see the branch manifestation of it. You see the inflammation, you see the Sjogren's, you see the psoriasis, the psoriatic arthritis, the RA, the whatever it is that they're presenting with, but you don't see what's causing it. And the channel divergences represent this concept of working with what's hidden.
Well, kind of the body knows what's probably causing it. It's just that it escapes the logic of the physicians that are just looking at symptoms as purposeless. You know, like a lot of it depends on your philosophy of how you interpret a symptom, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Does it have a purpose? Does it have a purpose, an ultimate purpose, or is it just something that is caused by the disease instead of caused by the body's response to the disease? There's a subtle difference in that, right?
But there's a huge difference in that as well. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's you're looking at pathological responses of the body versus physiological responses of the body. We get sick, we get a fever. That's a physiological response that's healthy. If that fever reaches a certain temperature, it becomes pathological. But if, you know, if I have a fever of 100 and I'm feeling crummy because I'm fighting something off, that fever of 100 is not pathological in the slightest. Right. It's actually the healthy physiological response. When I get hot and I sweat, it's not pathological.
Even amongst all the autoimmune diseases, you know, there's overlap, but they're so different as far as how they manifest, like you mentioned before.
There's all these different tissues of the body that can be affected, and that's possibly related to the genetics of the person. Maybe they are more prone to stomach disorders because of other facets of their life.
Well, I was thinking of like Sjogren's syndrome, Justin. Like I have a lot of good following of that. And they're all very dry. And it's interesting when you look at their lifestyle, they never drink water. They never eat yin, like kind of moistening foods and things like that. Mm-hmm. Their hormones are very low, which you mentioned with blood and the dryness. So there's some similarities you see.
Absolutely. Any chronic inflammatory condition burns up the yin, because it creates a certain amount of heat in the body. It dries us out. So when you have a certain amount of internalized heat for a matter of years, the body eventually becomes taxed. It's worn out. It's like being dehydrated. You know, if we don't drink water for a day, our body gets a little dehydrated. But if we don't drink enough water for months and years, not enough that we're going to, of course, perish. We're not going to die from it. But the body eventually starts to dry out. And if we don't take the time to eat the right foods and to live the type of lifestyle that nourishes us, that hydrates us on an emotional level, on a spiritual level, and on a physical level, the body eventually gets dehydrated on all of those levels. And then if a person isn't willing to make those lifestyle changes, then what you try to do is you try to look at their history and ask the question, why? You know, hopefully without judgment. As a practitioner, we want to just be there and support our patients.
Right.
But to really ask somebody like, okay, so you know you're dehydrated. You know this lifestyle is hurting you. Why do you keep doing it? Why won't you break the pattern?
Why? Exactly.
Why not drink another glass of water every day? Like if you keep forgetting over the course of years and months, then you're not really forgetting. There's something there that's stopping you from doing that. And so then we try to investigate what that is and heal that.
That's the main. Yeah, you're right. You nailed it on the head there. That there's some type of a inner pattern, an obstacle to cure. But the obstacle is not only just drinking the water, but it's the whole thought process, lifestyle.
Yeah.
Something that's inhibiting the patient from doing that. You know.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, health is our natural gift, right? We get a cut, that wound heals. We get a burn, that wound heals. That's our natural capacity. When that doesn't happen, something is out of whack. right? Something is off. And so we should remember that healing is our natural gift. It's our natural disposition. And if it's not happening, then we want to start to investigate as like, well, what's the cause? What's going on? And again, without judgment, because, you know, many people facing chronic diseases carry a lot of guilt or shame or embarrassment around the fact that they're not getting better. And it's important that we not, you know, we don't judge them for not getting better, but we also sort of gently present what some of the reasons might be. And if they're resistant to it, is inquire why, you know, and look to see, why is it that you won't take time to eat better?
We might be the only practitioners that are looking at the psyche and aligning the psyche and looking at the different facets of the psyche and why they can't heal. Because if you think about it, the body, like you mentioned before with the cut analogy, the body should heal from the chronic disease. It should, you know, the GI tract heals, you know, goes through the healing process within a couple of weeks. True neurological tissue and tendons and ligaments take a long time to heal, but think about it. When people are chronically ill, their body has had a chance to regenerate. You know, think about it. You know, the new cells, but yet they're still ill. So what's the misalignment?
Yeah, you can call it. One of my teachers likes to call it psychosclerosis. Sort of the hardening of the mind, right? We get stuck in emotional patterning and physical patterning and spiritual patterning. And sometimes we don't know that we are, you know, and it's not our fault for not having necessarily, having the tools to do that sort of deep self-observant work to see where our patternings are. That's where I find looking at our life history can be very insightful. To allow people to start to see things in a bigger picture of their life. Because for most people, once we see the patterning, it's hard for us to turn away from it. It's hard for us to ignore it anymore.
They might say, I don't have enough money. I don't have enough money. I have to work all these jobs. And that's, if I work so many jobs, I can't, I don't have time to shop. I don't have time to exercise. I'm sure you've heard all the excuses that people give for not following a helpful path. You know, I have to get out then because I'm not planning my meals and I'm not sleeping because I'm thinking of work. And so I guess as a practitioner, your job is to look at that and then find somewhere to enter into that equation and make a different outcome come out.
Yeah, working with chronic disease in Chinese medicine, we call it like trying to untangle a knot. And you sort of just have to try and find the right space to make that first tug on the string to untangle the knot. And it's not always easy, but you try to look at what's happening with the body and figure out the best way to initiate that process of healing or that process of awakening. For the person of like, oh, I could change this one thing. Okay, I don't have time to go to the gym right now. I don't have time to go to Whole Foods and buy all this organic food and cook this 5-hour meal. But you know what? I can drink an extra glass of water every day.
And there you go. And pat yourself on the back for doing that and take those baby inch by inch. It's a cinch. By the yard, it's hard, but inch by inch, it's a cinch. I'm always. Living that myself and encouraging patients to do the same, you know?
Yeah, and as a physician, what we try to do is have the knowledge to know, okay, well, if they make 1 inch in this one area, that will make a bigger impact than making an inch of progress in another area. We just try and give them a guidance of where they can make the most, get the most bang for their buck.
Right. I'm like a magnifying glass that's trying to focus energy on one part of their life that I think is going to have a ripple effect on other parts of their life. Yeah. And tell us a little bit about, unfortunately, we're running out of time. We're going to have you back on and talk more about philosophy. That's for sure. But tell us, before we run out of time, how people can get in touch with you.
You can find me at my website, which is just my name. It's justinerlich.com.
I spell Ehrlich.
It's E-H-R. LICH.
Right.
And probably the easiest way to find me. I'm not a big Instagram or a Facebook sort of person in terms of social media. I'm on LinkedIn, but my website is the best place to find me. And you can reach me via email or phone off of there.
Great. Wonderful.
And I'm happy to, my website sort of explains a lot of what I do. I work with people here locally in San Diego, but I also work with people around the country and internationally as well. I'm not limited because acupuncture is only one tool that I use. Many of the other tools are not required for me to be in person. Obviously, I can't do acupuncture if you're not here in front of me. But
well, you could do life coaching and
some and of this, herbal medicine and right. essential oils and meditation stuff. All that stuff can be done at a distance. And so I work with people around the world.
Nice. So that's by the way, issue. before we leave, we got about a minute. What is biohacking techniques?
Well, biohacking is ways of improving the body's function. Right. So you see all the different things, whether it be certain exercise things, whether it be sleeping things, whether it be dietary things that are popular within that community, which is called biohacking. But it's a way to improve the function of your biology. And now they're becoming more specified when they talk about biohacking or neurohacking or sleep hacking. And really the Taoists were, in my opinion, the yogis, the Taoists, the monks were the first biohackers. They came up with herbal medicines and lifestyles, whether that be a breathing exercise, whether that be yoga or Dao Yin or Qigong or stretching or martial arts, eating habits, meditation habits were ways to improve the function of the body. And modern science is now also going down that road of coming up with different techniques like blue light blocking glasses and bulletproof coffee and all okay. those sorts of things.
Well, thanks, Justin. And we're going to sign out for this edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thanks for this really insightful program. Take care and have a wonderful day.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye and stay healthy.